And welcome to Artifacts. I'm your host, Marissa Dickens, and today's guest is visual artist Emma Kathleen Hepburn Ferrer. Welcome!
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. So I discovered Emma and her work in a recent article in the Ola magazine. I actually got it through, I follow this dance edit newsletter, and it was an article because I didn't realize you did ballet, which is great. You know, I'm a dancer.
Are you a dancer?
You know,
so. Are you?
Yes, oh, I am.
Yes.
Oh yeah,
good
you get
for
it.
You.
So they posted that article, and I was like, "Wait!" So I was reading, like, "Oh my gosh! Like, your art is just is really cool." So it talked about
Thank you.
New exhibition, The Scapegoat, and for me, I love the complex themes surrounding your works, the colors. And I feel like your work invokes a sense of empathy, which I think the world needs a lot right now.
Definitely, definitely.
What has it been like showcasing your art in your first solo exhibition, and what has the response been?
It's been incredible, and the response has sort of been, you know, better than I could have imagined in my wildest dreams. I've sort of like shown my work in very, very small group shows, but this, as you said, is the first time that I've ever shown my work in a solo show. And I recently graduated with my MFA from St. Martin's over the summer in London. I was doing a blended hybrid sort of low residency program, so I would travel there a few weeks out of the year. But I've sort of just like been in this, you know, echo chamber with myself in my studio and just making work. And then the first time that you really put it out there into the world and you actually see that people understand the concepts that you're, you know, you're presenting and they connect with the work, it's like such a massive confidence boost and motivator. So it's just been, I mean, it feels, this is sort of all I've ever wanted, you know, to do with my life. So it just really feels amazing to be taking, you know, these first kind of major steps in my career.
It's funny with art, it's like your personal baby, and then you just kind of release it into the world, and you're like biting your fingers, like, is this gonna like be received well? And that's awesome. I've seen so many articles about it, and I'm like, okay, it's popping off. So that's exciting. That's exciting for sure.
Thank you.
Your journey is crazy. I want to start from the beginning. So would you say you mostly grew up?
Okay, so I was born in Switzerland, lived there until I was about 3, and then I moved to Los Angeles with my parents, and I stayed there until I was 11, and then between the ages of 11 and sort of 13, I was going back and forth between Italy and Los Angeles, where you are now. And then when I was 14, I moved to Florence, Italy, definitively. And that's where I did. So part of middle school, high school, and then art school. I went to the Florence Academy of Art, which is a very traditional, hyper sort of classical, traditional painting atelier. And then I moved to New York as a young adult when I was about 20, stayed there for 6 years or so, and now it's 4 years that I'm back in Italy in a very small town about an hour and a half away from Florence, but still in Tuscany sort of.
That is crazy to be in such iconic areas, you know, especially at a young age too. I mean, through that those beginnings, and what was your earliest memory or exposure to art, any type of art?
I mean, I can, so as you read, I was a dancer, of course, very sort of dedicated classical ballerina, you know, up until I was about 12-ish. And I was sort of studying every day with this very rigorous Russian teacher who only had, you know, like 5 students studying with him. And we would sort of dance, even in professional ballets, like with the American Ballet Theater and the Kirov, sort of in these children's roles. And so I very much sort of thought that I was on my way to becoming a dancer. But at the same time, even when I was much younger, I can always remember I would take drawing and painting classes after school when I was really little. And then when I was about 16, I started, well, once when I was 15, and then the summer after, I did pre-college painting classes at RISD and then at Pratt, and those were sort of like 4 to 6 weeks long and incredibly immersive. You know, we were living on campus, and that was really the first time that I was living with other artists. And sort of working on, you know, my this visual art painting drawing every day. And I felt so alive and stimulated. And that's when I really knew that that's what I wanted to do with my life, I think. And then, of course, later when I moved to Florence is when I found myself all of a sudden like in the seat of the Renaissance and like so all of a sudden coming from Los Angeles, alive and inspired, and I felt so kind of in touch with this sense of like identity and inner self that I think you're developing when you're 14, and so that was extremely formative as well.
From your perspective, do you think being an artist is a natural talent or is it a learned skill?
You've opened a can of words at worms. I have a lot of opinions on the matter. So the school that I went to in Florence when I graduated from high school, I was sort of planning on going to like a contemporary modern day university. Ironically, I was planning on going to St. Martin's to do my bachelor's, which is where I ended up doing my master's. But I had sort of like packed my bags and was going to London, and then at the last minute I went to look at this school in Florence that my dad had heard about because he knew someone, you know, who was an administrator there. And I like when I walked in, I sort of realized that it wasn't necessarily the work that was coming out of this school wasn't necessarily, you know, emblematic of the kind of artist that I wanted to be, but it represented something that I didn't have and that I realized I wanted and I needed, which was control in my work and, you know, ability to paint and to draw. And I didn't have that. You know, I was sort of the youngest person when I was admitted at the school. The program has since changed, and a lot of younger people go now, even out of high school. But at the time, it was mostly much older people who had come to art, you know, like wanting to perfect this very specific kind of naturalistic 19th century method of drawing and painting. And so I really realized that it represented this thing that I didn't have, and therefore I wanted it. And when I went to this school, I mean, they literally tell you when you walk through the door, like, check your creativity at the door. It will not serve you here. This is a science. Anyone can learn it. Anyone can learn it because you're not really even learning how to draw and paint. You're learning how to see. And if you learn how to see, you have to train your eye. So, for example, I spent like a year and a half literally just copying drawings, not even necessarily working. I mean, we would work half of the day from the model, and then for 3 hours a day for a year and a half, I would just copy drawings made by Charles Barg, who was this 19th century painter. He was a student of Bouguereau, and he made these pedagogical drawings where if you copy them, and like not just sort of copy them, but they have to be exact to the millimeter. Like they would literally come and like measure, and you know, the line
What?
weight has to be, yeah, no. Like you
That's
would make a
intense.
drawing, you would hold it up to one of your classmates, and it would be identical. Like, and you would hold it up to the model that you were drawing from, and it would
Ah.
be identical. And so that is obviously, yes, I mean, like there are certain people who are more who have a natural, you know, ability to draw, but the way that they teach it is really something that anyone can learn. And I don't think that you need necessarily talent, as you say, to do that. However, I always then also think about Andrew Wyeth, who was like one of my favorite painters ever. He sort of, so his father was N.C. Wyeth, who was a very famous illustrator. He did like the sort of he did like Robinson Crusoe and all of these really, really classical old books. He illustrated them. He was an amazing draftsman, and he started teaching Andrew when he was young to draw and paint in this very sort of like meticulous, you know, academic way. And he wouldn't let him just sort of like doodle as a kid would, but he would like, set him up with a still life and like make him like really teach him how to draw in the scientific way, if you will. And people would ask him, "Aren't you afraid that you're gonna kill like the creative instinct that Andrew has by teaching him this rigorous method of drawing?" And he said, "No, if Andrew has that, it's something that I can never take away from him. There's nothing I could do that, that could kill that." And then, fast forward, Andrew Wyeth is like one of the most incredible painters to have ever lived and outshone his father. So, I mean, there are like two sides of the coin. I think that there is an approach to drawing and painting, and there is an aspect of drawing and painting that anyone can learn. But at the same time, there obviously is the artist's identity, and that is something unique. And I think that everyone kind of has it to a degree, and it's expressed, it can be expressed in, anyway, I'm babbling, but it can be expressed through drawing and painting or through writing or through, there's an art to everything. So,
I guess too, another element is how it's nurtured as well. That's a very
exactly.
interesting point of view. Because I've asked some people before, and people are very like, "Oh no, it's natural." People are like, "No, it's learned skill." So it's very interesting. I think I
Yeah.
do believe in the both.
I think it is really important, especially if there's a natural ability. Like, I think artists have to learn that skill. And unfortunately, I don't really like drawing. I'm not much of a draftswoman, but it is so important to learn how to draw. And it is so important to learn. Like, I think that it doesn't mean you have to make academic drawings and paintings for the rest of your life, but I do think like you need to learn a skill that anyone can learn.
Like dance, it's like you need, like, you can have a natural, like, technical ability, but you may not be the
Exactly.
best hip hop dancer. I don't know, there's just so many elements to it that's not interesting.
Exactly. It's like me, like another really good analogy is music. Like you would never just sit someone down and say like, okay, compose, Beethoven's Ninth. Like you have to learn how to, how to, first of all, how to write music, and then you have to learn how to copy other people's music, and then you can get to the point where you're good enough to create your own thing because you have the skill,
So then, for you, how did you find and cultivate your own artistic identity and your own style?
So, I sort of gra then I graduated from this school when I was about 20 from the Florence Academy of Art. And it's not like I all of a sudden knew how to draw and paint, but I had a very sound, I could represent life naturalistically, and I could paint sort of quote unquote well and draw quote unquote well. But I didn't really understand what my art was about or how to make art that was about something. And that is a different set of tools. And that is not something that we learned. We didn't learn how to be creative artists. Remember, I told you they told us to check that at the door. So when I then this so I sort of went through like my 20s painting on the side and like constantly making work, but work that was about all of these different things and about everything and sort of nothing at the same time. I mean, that's very diminutive to the work that I made. I made some good work during that time. But I kind of realized I really need to learn like the craft of being an artist now, not just being a painter. And so I started looking around at MFA programs, and I knew that by that time I had already moved back to Italy during the pandemic, but I knew that I wanted to stay in Italy, that I had found, I had come back to this place that I had been like, craving this whole time that I was in New York. I was really happy to be back and I wasn't ready to leave. So I found this amazing. It used to be called Fine Art Digital. I think it's called Fine Art Global now or something. So it's an MFA that's mostly online, and then you can go there like, two or three times a year for 2 weeks at a time. And yeah, I mean, like that 2 year program was everything to me. I mean, I had an amazing cohort of people, and as I'm sure people who have done MFAs can relate to, it's just such a fervent and fertile period of discovery. And I credit so much to my tutor, Jonathan Kearney, at the school. But that was really, I think, when I learned how to be an artist, how to have this, how to continually feed this muscle that needs to be fed. You can't make art in a vacuum. Like, where do you find your inspiration? What does it mean to you? How do you process it? How do you keep that muscle active every day, kind of? Because just painting isn't enough. It has to be fed by other things.
I like how too you did Love educational route, and then you meet other students. It's almost like a little hub where you all influence each other and talk and inspire,
Exactly.
and which again
It's really
cultivates
important.
more.
Yeah, I'm kind of like a naturally introverted person, and I don't really like, seek community, but I really realized how important it is to have like people to talk things through with and people to learn from. And I kind of have that now that I'm out of my MFA in a way. I mean, I have my boyfriend who's also a sculptor, and there are some artists that he sort of works with in his environment. And you find people along the way that can mentor you, and then like you really, I mean, I really attach myself to them, because it's so important to have like a mirror to hold yourself up to. You can't just be like alone,
So I want to shift now to your exhibition. So
Yeah, please.
what was the initial inspiration behind your series of works?
So that body of work started literally at the beginning of my MFA. I had recently moved back to Italy, as I said, and was just like, I mean, as I said, when I was 14 and I had just moved to Florence, I was like overwhelmed and so inspired and like so happy and learning about humanism and the Renaissance and like so stimulated. And then when I finally moved back, to Italy after having been in New York, that really came up again. Like, I really realized how tied my artistic identity is to this place, maybe because I had those formative years in high school here. But I was all of a sudden very in this very rural location, sort of steeped in centuries and centuries of history, and actually like the relics of that history and churches and the most beautiful nature, and also these very sort of complex traditions and dynamics that guide everyday life here. Like, religion is so much more a part of everyday life. And there's this hunting culture that's, because I live in this very rural area, there are a lot of hunters, and I live in the woods, sort of, on the side of a mountain. So I'm like constantly hearing it and seeing it, and I found myself so stimulated by all of these things. And so I started looking at the role of the church, and I started making works that sort of looked at devotion and what Christianity looks like, in this historical yet also contemporary context. And that led me to rediscover a painting by William Holman Hunt that I became obsessed with back when I was at the Florence Academy of Art 10 years ago. And this came back to me, and I sort of I started researching the painting. It's called The Scapegoat, and I understood that it's not only one of the most incredibly executed paintings, like one of the most beautiful paintings, just from a technical point of view, but it's so profound. And it comes from this myth from the Old Testament in the Bible, where a community would actually take a goat, well, two goats, but they would take a goat. One they would just slaughter and sacrifice, and then they would take this other goat, which would become the scapegoat, and they would tie its horns with red thread or red ribbon, and they would, through this sort of rituality, they would impregnate the goat with all of their suffering and all of their pain and sickness and sin and shame and all of these things that, the community is carrying with them, and then in this cathartic way cleanse themselves of it, and they would send the goat out into the wilderness to die alone by itself. And so this painting by William Holman Hunt is a painting of the scapegoat alone in the desert, in the Dead Sea, which is the lowest place on earth. Literally, it's like the lowest, below sea level, and there are these carcasses of these past scapegoats, these dead goats in the background, and he's all alone and so frightened, and there's this gorgeous landscape behind him. And I was just so like moved and obsessed with this story. And then I also realized how relevant and how present this story is in my own surroundings, and looking at hunting and this culture of community of hunters and groups of hunters that go out in this very ritualistic way and like encircle the animal and chase it. And then they're so elated and they're euphoric and, they're cleansed in a way. And so I started making this series of work about the scapegoats. I have my own version of the scapegoat, which is an homage to the painting by William Holman Hunt, and then all of these other kind of scapegoats and these other animals that I, from other stories, some from before the Bible, some from after the Bible, some are things that I've literally seen in my everyday life here, like lost hunting dogs in the woods who have sort of been alone for 3 weeks, left to fend for themselves. And this sort of gave birth to this body of work called The Scapegoat.
I really like your perspective on this spiritual religious aspect because religion is seen throughout a lot of art throughout history. And I like, especially with nature, like in your work is very like fr the fragility of nature and
Absolutely.
and a lot of your paintings too, like isolation as well. And
Definitely,
those, for me,
absolutely.
those scream out for me.
A huge theme. I mean, I'm looking at nature, man, God, animal. These are sort of these elements. And then you have an animal alone in the woods, and it touches on all of those themes because you have the animal who's sort of been abandoned by man, the presence of God through nature, sort of these very kind of emotional landscapes, or what will you, which is for me sort of like a, that's the presence of God kind of in a Spinozian sense. But anyway, sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I just, yeah, I like again, like those themes. That's why for me, it invoked a sense of empathy because you look at these poor animals, but then you're like, oh, wait, I feel like humans have done something, you know? I mean, there's just a lot of things to unpack, but especially in this day and age. Again, just very, yeah, very, very interesting, very thought-provoking, which I think
Thank you.
is
Thank
really
you.
cool.
Thank
What
you.
do you specifically, whether it's a emotion, what do you want viewers to take away from your whole exhibition if they could take away something?
You know, the curator, Annabelle Keenan of the show, asked me that question. And I think that there are so many metaphors that the scapegoat can stand for, and so many contemporary contextuality as well. However, it can also represent nothing. It can also just purely be that story. You know, it can be a very, very simple story of empathy for this goat and, you know, cruelty of man, unfairness, you know, justice. What God, sort of where is God in all of this? But I did sort of start to realize recently that I have started to kind of, I mean, I'm working on my next body of work now, which is very much an evolution of that. I mean, it's no longer really goats, but I'm looking at other stories, you know, some much older, some more present, more contemporary, of this similar dynamic that involves animal and God and man and nature. So what do I want people to take away from it? I think that they are ultimately about empathy in a very, very deep way, and about the people or about the things, or you know, that are the scapegoat. Like, what is the scapegoat of our society? The curator mentioned this incredible story, the people who walked away from Ocellus, I think, which is a book by, I have to remember, look up the name of the writer, I can't remember now. It's about a society of people who are so happy and their society is so wonderful, and this short story opens up when they're on this day of celebration, this annual day of celebration, and the skies are so blue and crystal, and the wind is blowing, and the horses are, you know, riding. And it starts to slowly reveal that the entirety of this society is hinges on a little child who is essentially a prisoner, who lives in this dungeon beneath the city, who is tied up and restrained and afraid and alone, and sort of slowly becoming, I mean, it's horrible. It's slowly sort of becoming retarded by, you know, because it's left alone. I mean, or, you know, and so everyone knows that the beauty in their society depends on that child. Some wish to sort of reject it, some walk away from Ocellus, some leave the society, which is the name of the story. And it's such a, I mean, it can, that in and of itself is a metaphor for so many things. I mean, you can look at the climate, you can look at, you know, whatever is happening in America now, you know, immigration. There are so many scapegoats that in a way help, I mean, not help society, but that through their suffering, society continues to flourish and to grow and, you know, So that is something that I'm thinking of more presently now, about how present that dynamic really is in my work. I mean, before I was sort of kind of in denial of it having that like contemporary, tie-in, and I was just much more like, no, I'm really into the story of the Bible, and I'm into religion, and I'm into history, and it's not really about now, but it is ultimately very much about now, I think.
Throughout all your experiences, I like asking this question, like, this is a hard, like, what is art to you? Is it to make, to provoke? Is it to entertain? I mean, to me, in a personal way, like, just my gut reaction is like, art is devotion. I mean, not even in like devotion that I'm looking at as a concept, but just to me, like, I'm so devoted to it. And I paint every day, and sometimes it's like really hard because I also, I also work. I still have a part-time job. And so I think you really do need to be like fully committed. And so that's what it represents on a personal level. But I guess there is an aspect of service. Like the word service comes to mind, in that I do think that art is so important, and that you owe it, as the artist owes society to make their, not to make art that they think is going to serve society, but the art that is true to them is going to serve society. And doing art that's authentic to you and that is important to you, that is sort of where like this concept of God, or and I'm not a religious person, but I think quite deeply about spirituality myself. That's where this concept comes in, because I do believe that we have, I mean, there's passion versus purpose, and sometimes they overlap, sometimes they don't, but I do think that the artist has a responsibility to make that art, and then whatever happens in the world with it, is to be seen. But art helps people discover things and beauty and, about themselves. So I think that art is also service. I really like that, devotion and service. I've never heard someone describe it as service. That makes complete sense for my
It is.
brain. Do you have any exciting projects to look forward to? 'Cause I know you just said you're building more work and
Well, I mean, I don't really know. I think I'm going to have works in the Dallas Art Fair, which is coming up in April, which is exciting. And then, I always say I really want to show my work in Europe, just because I had this like amazing full circle moment when I was in New York, where I invited all these people from my life, like in America and when I was living in New York, and so many people came and showed up for me, which I'm like so immensely grateful for. And having that experience with them, like I really, took the time to talk to everyone who came and like to look them in the eyes and spend that time with them. And so I want to have that as well with my community in Europe, because I have a community, a huge community here in Europe as well. So I want to show my work in Europe sometime soon, and just, keep painting and hope that like my career goes well, because this is really what I want to do. It's my biggest
It's
goal
exciting,
and
It's
dream.
like the first launch, and then you just have more. That's exciting.
Exactly. Thank you.
I have to ask, because you're the
Of course.
granddaughter of Audrey
Yes.
Hepburn,
Of course.
why do you think people still love Audrey Hepburn after all these years?
Yeah.
What is it?
If I had the answer, I mean, my dad has asked himself this question a lot. My dad is the son of Audrey Hepburn, and he kind of has his own way that he answers. He thinks that she, beyond representing this, universal and infinite and immortal elegance and beauty and generosity, that she kind of represents an accessibility, if you will, someone that you can relate to, someone who's not about, ungodly glitz and glamour, but that, and that is something that he sees comes from her own personal experience, because she lived through the war and she was, a refugee, and that's why she dedicated her life to UNICEF later on. And so he thinks that she represents something that people, a kind of deep-seated, even a kind of suffering that people can relate to. But what's my answer? I mean, it's probably not dissimilar. I think that she was a person who, I think that the concept of fame today is so different from the concept of fame back then, because also fame is something that can be achieved through different means today. You know, you can make yourself famous on Instagram, for example, whereas before
Everyone
you had to
wants to be
rely
fit,
on,
yeah.
yeah, you had to rely on, or you could even self-publish a book. I mean, it's very kind of anarchic, the concept of fame that way, whereas before you had to rely on the institution of Paramount Pictures or whatever it was, you know. So there's that, and then the fact that she was so hardworking and dedicated and never took what she had for granted because of where she came from, I think created this incredible sort of humanity in her and this humbleness. She was so modest, and you know, today, like people like myself, you can be the daughter or the grandchild of someone really famous, and it's all just sort of handed to you that way. Whereas she had a different kind of background, and I think that people intuitively see that. And you know, she was ultimate. It's going to be so cheesy. She was such a good person, and no one, like, something that my dad always says is that no one ever had anything bad to say about her. And every single person I've ever met who had has met her has said that she was at so as beautiful and lovely and kind she seems on screen or in photos, she was like tenfold. She was like a million times that when you met her in person, and just her like kindness was literally overwhelming. And you know, it's sad that I never got to meet her, but that I think is something that people like intuitively see through and love her for it.
Like you said earlier, this like genuineness and authenticity.
Yeah,
I think people can
exactly.
people know that.
You can see it exactly.
For you, how do you think your art carries on both your own in spirit, but also maybe a little hint of legacy of Audrey?
Yeah. You know, I had this kind of revelation. I was in China recently because there is an exhibition called Intimate Audrey that my dad created that has toured a little bit around Europe, and now it's touring around China about my grandmother, sort of a beautiful archive of over 1,000, you know, thousands of photographs and some memorabilia, but it's more about sort of the concept of Audrey Hepburn as opposed to like the objects that represent her, to sort of move away from materialism in that way. But I had this kind of revelation when I was in China. I went to China literally like 2 weeks before my solo show in New York opened, and I
Wow,
was there for 2 weeks. It was a super busy time, but I was talking, you know, giving all of these interviews and speaking on stage and for the inauguration of this show for this exhibition about my grandmother. And I kind of really realized, I had this just like aha moment that everything that my grandmother stood for in her, especially in her later years when she dedicated her life, gave her life to UNICEF, which is reminding people of the victims of our society. Because at the time when she was alive, she never, we didn't have, she was like the first person to come from this Hollywood developed world of money and glamour and go into these developing countries and actually like touch these children and like touch their mothers. And we saw this incredible union on screen, and no one had ever seen that before. And it was, you know, it was this reminder, or not even a reminder, because people didn't really know. Like, while this is happening where we live, there is this alternate reality, you know, which has not, I mean, it's changed and evolved. It's, things are different now because of different conditions and sort of climate change. And, you know, at the time when she was working with UNICEF, a child would die of a preventable cause every 20 seconds, whereas I believe that that number has grown and that less often a child dies of a preventable cause, but there are other, all of these other crises now, you know, mass migration and whatnot. So she sort of taught people like who the brunt of society was, and that kind of, I really realized, like, holy shit, like, my work is about the scapegoat and about these innocent victims, and they're about this sensation of empathy, which is what she really had. And I think that that's something that, to answer your question before about what people intuitively see in her, it's this incredible, like, generosity, but also this incredible empathy. And so I kind of realized, like, wow, I think that my work, without ever really wanting it, is just sort of naturally and innately carrying on the legacy that she started in a way. Because it, I think that, through whatever it is, through my own medium and art, I hope, going back to the question that you asked before, I hope that people can see what they want to see in it, or rather, through this sort of universal sensation of empathy, understand the relevance that they need to understand in their life and in regards to society.
Empathy, 100%, 100%.
Yeah.
I
Yeah.
agree. Before we end, we have some fun rapid fire questions. These are like
Yes,
fun, just like your
love
first
that,
answer. Okay.
please.
Favorite female artist?
Favorite female artist. I mean, Marlene Dumas comes to mind. I think she's an excellent painter. I love how this Renaissance painter, Plautille Lanelli, is having this, like, she's having her own Renaissance now. Like, people are sort of becoming more curious about the female painters that lived concurrently with all of these male masters and made beautiful work. And she's done amazing work as well and whatnot. And then who else? I really like Marlene Dumas' work, I have to say. I think she's a great, great, great living painter.
You
Yeah.
have any painting rituals?
I mean, it's the rituality of everyday painting. I really try and maintain that. Sometimes I take a day or two off on the weekend, especially if I've had a really intense week, because I basically like paint in my mornings until 3 p.m. and then I have a job. I have a remote job where I work in the US just because I'm still maintaining myself that way. So I'm frequently like working until 11 p.m. because I'm on New York hours living in Europe. So then I like wake up and work out or go to the gym or whatever, and then paint. So it can get intense, that routine, but the, like, going back to the devotion, like the dedication to painting every day is a rituality for me, for sure, trying to maintain that as much as I can.
Stripes or polka dots?
Stripes.
Favorite color to work with?
To work with in what way? Like, to if you want to leave
To
it
paint, to
open-ended.
paint. You could leave it open. I
To
mean, yeah.
paint.
Or wear, I don't know. Whatever.
Gonna say yellow ochre. I mean, yeah, that's sort of the main thing that's always on my palette, no matter what. Yellow ochre. Is it? Yes. I'm just gonna go with yellow ochre.
Last great book you read?
Oh my God. I read this book of poetry that I'm now obsessed with. It's called The Hocus Pocus of the Universe by Laura Gilpin. And I discovered this female poetess, American, who was a nurse and worked as a nurse her whole life, but was also this incredible poetess. And I think she won a prize during her life. So it's not like she was totally unrecognized during her life, but her poetry, like, really the simplicity of it and the accessibility of it and like the universality of it is something that I really try to honor, or I try to portray in my own work and as a painter as well. I really just see this, I feel like this concurrence with her work as a poetess and my work as a,
I'll also look it up. I love some poetry.
yeah.
Besides the classics, what Audrey Hepburn movie do you recommend people to watch? An underrated.
Wait Until Dark, which is one that a lot of people have not seen, or A Nun's Story. But I remember when I first saw Wait Until Dark, I was like, wait, like, this is my grandmother's in this movie? This, because I was so used to seeing her in like Breakfast at Tiffany's or Roman Holiday or Sabrina or Funny Face, like these iconic films. And then this is sort of very much more like, I actually don't know if it's an independent film or not, but it feels like an independent film, and that the entirety of the movie is taking place in this essentially room in her apartment. She's a blind woman. The clothes are not what you would expect to see from Audrey Hepburn, and that's done on purpose because the wardrobe, I mean, she had a very active role in choosing all of the wardrobe of her films, and she garnered the power to do that as she progressed in her career. But she chose the clothes as, I mean, she helped elect the clothes that a blind person would choose. So not based on aesthetic, but based on comfort and look and texture and feel. And then it's like a horror movie, which is so cool.
That's
And there,
interesting.
it's really, and it's like a psychological thriller. And it's just such a different role from any other role that she, I think that those two films, A Nun's Story and Wait Until Dark, were important films for her as an artist because they're not like, I mean, obviously the other films that I referenced are incredible, but these ones are very much about, I think that they're kind of like a method actor's film, you know, like she had to really embody the role of a nun or embody the role of a blind person and live that like kind of traumatizing experience. So I think that they're really important roles from the point of view of acting as a craft.
Favorite museum?
Ooh, that is a hard one because I go to so many museums. I may try and do it like by region. So I love Isabella Stewart Gardner in the US. The Prado is like pretty impressive. But then again, there are some smaller, like, I'm really into like what we call today site-specific work. So not necessarily museums, but like going to like a church where like a fresco was made for that church and it still lives in that church and hasn't been like transported to like Washington, D.C. or something completely out of its context. So I love going to Italy and seeing, you know, there are just so many incredible chapels. There's the Scrovegni Chapel in Padova with all of the Giotto and Brancacci in Florence by Masaccio. And then my absolute favorite is, well, my favorite painter of all time is Piero della Francesca, and the chapel in Arezzo in the Church of Saint Francis is like to me the absolute ultimate. I mean, there is another one with La Madonna del Parto, which is this fresco of a pregnant Madonna, which is not too far from Arezzo, but those would be the ones that like if I had to only go to like five museums for the rest of my life, I
It's
might be
there's so
choosing.
many great ones, and being here
I
in
know.
Los Angeles, I'm like, oh, there's just like little, there's just so much, there's so much.
Yeah,
I like to
exactly.
Ohio. I'm from Toledo, Ohio, and I like a little museum because you could just, it's not
Oh,
overwhelming, and it's a good it's
exactly.
a good collection for Toledo, so.
You have to re like when I went to like the Prado for the first time, or like the Louvre, but like
The
God,
Louvre
you
is a
really have
lot.
to be. The Louvre is a lot, but the Prado took us a good 8 hour. I mean, we actually saw everything, which was like so impressive. And
Wow.
we went with my stepbrother, who was like, he doesn't go to a lot of museums, but he looked at like he sort of made the mistake of looking very intently at the first like three paintings that he saw. And then he was like, I can't do this anymore. I'm leaving. And so he left and he was overwhelmed. And we got
Burned
through all of
himself
it, my
out.
boyfriend and I. Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. He burned himself out. My boyfriend and I are like legit art nerds. Like if we go on a trip, we will literally see every piece of art that that city has to offer.
Yeah. When you're not busy painting, what do you like to do for yourself?
Gosh, I wish I had more time like in my day as everyone does, but like I really want to just be, I really like being like present in my life and with my dogs, and I want to be able to take more walks in nature with them because I really live in like the most beautiful area, and it's going to be nice weather soon. And like I really, if I just had time to like cook dinner every night for myself and my partner, I would be happy because I love cooking. But I end up like being on, you know, work calls and stuff, so that doesn't always happen. And then just like reading is so important, like researching for my art, like reading that kind of reading. And I wish I had more time because it's so important. So hopefully I'll be able to work towards a place where I'm just painting. And the show has actually been going really well, and I'm really grateful for that. So hopefully that'll happen.
No, I'm with you there, being present and
Yeah.
enjoying a Sunday of doing nothing, something like that, you know, and
Exactly. I do
yeah.
that. I give myself those Sundays all like frequently. So I just want to have it more like in my everyday, just more like more time. This
Yeah.
is such a tall order. I just want more time. Yeah.
Don't we all? Well, thank
Yeah.
you so much for coming on
Thank
today. I
you.
loved learning about your journey and just talking with you and
Thank you so much. I hope I
listening
didn't
to
babble
you.
on.
No, it was great. I loved it.
Okay,
So,
thank you.
yes. And you can follow Emma on Instagram at EKH Ferrer, and then your website is www.emmaferrer.com. Again, thank you so much. And
Thank you
thank
so much, Marisa.
you.
This was a really, really wonderful interview. I'm so grateful to have a conversation about art. Thank you for the
Yes.
really stimulating questions.
And thank you to everyone listening in, and stay tuned for another episode next month.